Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Senate Majority Leader Dan Feltes is running in the Democratic primary for governor. Today, as part of our series of conversations with primary candidates, we'll speak with him about a variety of issues on voters' minds. Your comments and questions are welcome. You can send them in by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call now. That's the best way to get your question, 1-800-892-6477. Again, the number 1-800-892-NHPR. Senator Feltes, thank you very much for being here. We really appreciate it.
You got it, Peter. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks very much. So let's dive right in. Of course, school reopening is on the minds of lots of parents and educators right now. You outlined a school reopening plan this week that would require middle and high school students to wear masks. Elementary students would be encouraged to wear them. Governor Chris Sununu has said this is a decision that should be left to local communities. So you seem to feel differently. Why? Why is this not best handled locally?
Well, first and foremost, Governor Sununu said basically every decision would be left to local communities. Look, with 5 or so weeks to go before school starts, Peter, all parents wanted and all teachers wanted and all our kids wanted was some element of certainty in public health standards and public health support for our school districts. What Chris Sununu delivered wasn't certainty, it was absolute chaos. 100% local control, 100% flexibility means Chris Sununu takes no responsibility. It's the same thing Trump did, punted it down, Sununu punted it down. And now our schools, our families, and our teachers are left without any guidance at all and any support at all with just a few weeks to go. That's not right. That's not leadership. That's playing politics in a pandemic. So what we did, Peter, is work together with public health experts, working families, teachers on the ground, developed our own plan to put out there. It's called Live Free and Learn Safe. It provides clear public health guidance to our teachers, to our school districts. It lays out certain guidance about what happens when a kid gets sick, what happens with buses and with meals, what happens in scheduling if something happens. Clear, distinct guidance. And also, Peter, it supports our schools. So, for example, teachers get, under this plan, medical grade N95 masks. The average teacher, Peter, spends over $400 a year in New Hampshire out-of-pocket costs at school just to do their job. They shouldn't be spending any more out-of-pocket to be safe to do their job. So medical grade N95 masks for teachers, cloth reusable face coverings, 5 provided at the beginning of the school year for every kid in the state. That's what North Carolina did. If North Carolina can do it, New Hampshire can do it. Required in middle school, in high school, and on buses. On-site testing capacity, making sure that we take care of cleaning in the schools, making sure there are clear guidelines on social distancing, and clear guidance on buses.
Well, can I ask you about the cleaning situation? Because your plan calls for closing a school for a minimum of 2 days if there is a confirmed case to allow time for cleaning. If there's a risk of infection heading into the new school year, why not just require remote instruction across the state for at least the fall?
Well, Peter, what we've seen from the American Pediatric Society and others is that it is preferable to, if possible and if safely, to have in-classroom instruction. What is going on right now is that the state under Chris Sununu has not provided the resources or the certainty or the public health guidance to for school districts to safely reopen. So each school district is doing their own thing. And you know what? Folks on local school boards, they show up, they're serving the public in good faith. They're not, in most cases, not epidemiologists. They're not public health experts. They're doing their best. And what Chris Sununu did is just throw up his hands and said, you know what? You're on your own. I am of that belief that we are all in this together. And that leadership means making decisions, laying out clear public health guidance, whether it's on cleaning and buses and meals and what happens when the kid gets sick, and actually providing the support for our schools. Instead, Christine has not provided the support for our schools, the financial support. In fact, he supports Betsy DeVos and Trump administrations siphoning off public tax dollars to private schools, even right now under coronavirus relief efforts. That's not right. We need to plan for this and plan for the fall for our students, for our families, and our communities.
Let's stay on the topic of schools for a moment. You've touted the recent budget as the most progressive state budget in state history, with the biggest public education budget increase in state history, the biggest increase for schools since Governor Shaheen was in office. But what is your plan long term for funding public education in New Hampshire?
Thanks, Peter. We did that based on closing loopholes for big multi-state, multinational corporations, including companies that sell products into New Hampshire, like Netflix and Amazon, based on our corporate tax code, which is the biggest chunk of the state budget. Those sales were not payable under our corporate tax code. So closing that loophole so companies like big multi-state, multinational companies like Netflix and Amazon actually pay to the state of New Hampshire. That's in part how we develop the biggest public school education budget in state history. So I don't support a broad-based income tax or respect folks who take that position, but there is, in my view, what we need to do is close loopholes for those at the top. Big corporations and those at the top, have them pay their fair share so middle-class families who are taking it on the chin and property taxes get some relief. We invest in our schools and our communities and our teachers. We build a better future for Iris and Josie, Aaron and I's daughters, everybody's daughters and sons. I happen to believe the best investments we can make as a society, the investments we make in our kids, they're our future, and they deserve an opportunity and foundation for success that's as strong as the granite under our soil. We've got to build a bigger and better and brighter future for everybody. We can continue down that pathway, protect this budget, listen to the School Funding Commission and their recommendations. But we also have to do things like pre-K. We're one of only six states that do not provide support for pre-K. I first ran in 2014 talking about full day K. And we finally did this in this budget, despite Christine's objections, despite Christine wanting to tie kindergartners to Keno revenue. We finally untied that. We finally supported kindergartners like any other grade schooler. Early childhood education is critical, and we got to support education from cradle to career. We can continue to do that by closing those loopholes for those at the top.
Let me ask you about race and racial issues here in New Hampshire. As governor, what is the first step you'd take to address systemic racism in New Hampshire?
Well, first and foremost, I'd create, and I've proposed this, an office of racial equity within the governor's office. You need to lead from example and do that. So Vermont has done something similar, but the person who directs the office would be a person of color. It would be housed within the governor's office. And that office would work to identify systemic issues within state government, issues that disproportionately negatively impact communities of color, state policies that have that impact, identify them and work to eradicate them. It also involves communities of color in decision-making at the state level to make sure that we are cognizant of and do the outreach that's necessary to include more people in our democracy and economy. And in addition to that, provide recommendations on key posts within state government of persons of color. That's critical, Peter, to do that. Vermont's done it. We should do it. You can do that right now. Sununu could do it right now.
Governor Sununu, does he deserve any credit for the steps he's taken recently, including convening the COVID-19 equity response team?
Chris Sununu has said systemic racism doesn't exist. Look, it's one thing to create committees. That's another thing to acknowledge what actually exists and actually take concrete steps to move forward. I'm grateful that Chris Sununu ended up signing our criminal justice reform package, banning chokeholds as a mechanism for police, making sure that we have comprehensive bail reform. However, there's a lot more steps to do. And it starts by acknowledging that systemic racism exists everywhere. And whether it's subtle or overt, caught on tape or not, every day our Black brothers and sisters face words, actions, and policies that rob them of the American dream. we need to recognize that if we're going to take steps moving forward. And as a legal aid lawyer prior to serving in the state Senate, Peter, I've worked combating housing discrimination all around the state, working with the Manchester NAACP. The former president of Manchester NAACP supports this campaign, helping work with this campaign. We need policies that address this across the board, economic and housing justice, criminal justice reform. And it starts by acknowledging the problems exist.
What's your take on the debate regarding defunding the police?
I don't support defunding the police. What I support is making sure that we do reform and real reform. We've taken some steps recently, banning chokeholds, making sure that there is psychological exams, but we need implicit bias training. We need to update our police standards and training. And we need continue to move down the pathway of those reforms. We also need to protect everybody and relieve the pressure on our police by advancing our behavioral health system, Peter. We've made some steps on that. A bill I sponsored, Comprehensive Children's System of Care, a statewide mobile crisis intervention and stabilization services for children in distress, whether child protection involved or not. But we need support across the continuum of care. We need to support communities who are crying out for help right now, like Manchester and others that are talking about homelessness and mental health issues, and they need the capacity. Under Chris Sununu, he created something called the Doorways Program, but it was largely a doorway to nowhere, despite the best efforts of people on the ground. We need capacity in the back end. We need the back room. It's one thing to have a doorway and a referral system. It's another thing to have the capacity in the back end. And so we need to deal with treatment capacity in the state. Chris Sununu has vetoed addiction treatment services and other capacity issues, but we need to build out the capacity and do it at a state level. That relieves pressure on police, that focuses more on what they were trained to do, and it focuses more, all of us, on bringing down healthcare costs and providing access to everybody.
Listeners, if you've got a question for State Senator and Democratic candidate for Governor Dan Feltes, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to David in Keene. David, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
You're welcome. Climate change is one of the greatest challenges of our time and requires bold action. What would you do as governor to combat the climate crisis?
Thank you very much, David. Dan Feltes.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that. We're facing an existential threat. We got to address it at the local, state, and national level. We have a lot of work to do across three sectors of thermal energy, heating, home heating, electric, and also transportation. And we could talk for an hour about each one, but just briefly. On transportation, we need to ramp up our electric vehicle charging stations. Sununu is sitting on the Volkswagen settlement money, hasn't deployed it, but we need electric vehicle charging stations and we need to electrify the grid to make sure that's a real opportunity for folks. It's not just about combating the climate crisis, by the way, it's about economic and tourism impacts in the state. If you have an electric vehicle, you live in Massachusetts, you're determining whether or not to go to Maine or New Hampshire to camp in the summertime. And Maine has electric vehicle charging stations, New Hampshire doesn't, you're going to choose Maine, and New Hampshire loses out. So it's about combating the climate crisis, and it's about economics. On the thermal heating side, we need a comprehensive strategy, and Chris Sununu has vetoed a number of bills on this, to allow people to be able to transition to clean energy and heating their home. And at the opening segment, we heard a lot about this, but not a lot of folks have the opportunity to do that right now. Especially if you're lower and middle income. And the vast overwhelming majority of folks in Granite State heat their homes with natural gas or oil heat. And so we can't leave them behind. We need to open up access to transition to a clean energy economy for them as well. And on the electric side, we need to ramp up our renewable portfolio standard to get to 100% clean energy. There is a bill on Chris Sununu's desk right now, Senate Bill 124, that I suspect later on today, he'll veto it following 10 other clean energy vetoes that ramps up a renewable portfolio standard on the electric sector. And it does it significantly. And why is this all really important? And let me just talk about Chris Sununu's perspective for a second. He says the jury's out on climate change. His brother is a fossil fuel industry lobbyist. He has vetoed 10 clean energy bills, probably an 11th today. And by the way, this is not just about combating the climate crisis. It's about reducing electric and energy rates for everybody. clean energy. Don't let anybody tell you any different. Clean energy, distributed generation, and energy efficiency reduce rates. They don't increase them. So don't listen to that propaganda.
Well, can I ask you about Granite Bridge? Because you've supported the Granite Bridge natural gas pipeline project in the past, and activists have criticized you for not opposing the project outright. Do you believe New Hampshire should build new fossil fuel infrastructure?
Well, Granite Bridge is a connection between two existing pipelines, and the goal, at least purported, and it's at the Public Utilities Commission for review, is to meet the heating need in the wintertime. You know, I used to represent folks who, you know, had their natural gas heat cut off in the wintertime, represented tenants whose landlord didn't pay the natural gas bill, and they actually were heating their homes and their apartments with their electric ovens open. I saw that. So I'm sensitive to the issue of whether or not to cut people off of natural gas.
So in some circumstances, it would be okay to facilitate more fossil fuel infrastructure?
I will not. Well, if it meets existing demand for natural gas in the wintertime to heat your home, certainly, because you know what? I'm not going to be taking a position to cut people off of natural gas heat in the wintertime. What we need, as I said in the outset, in response to David's question, is we need actually to move forward so people who heat their homes with natural gas or oil heat in the wintertime have a meaningful opportunity to transition to clean energy. And the singular barrier to clean energy progress in New Hampshire, based on all of these vetoes, based on all the work that we've done as vice chair of the Energy Committee, serving on the Energy Committee for 6 years, sponsoring over 30 pieces of clean energy legislation, I can tell you the singular barrier is Chris Sununu. So that's where we need to focus, and that's where I'll focus all of my attention.
Let me ask you a question about the handling of the pandemic. You've been critical of Governor Sununu on long-term care facilities and the high number of deaths among nursing home residents from COVID-19. What would you do specifically to better protect people in nursing homes?
Well, first and foremost, Peter, we had a piece of legislation, House Bill 1246, that we specifically laid out how to do this. It provided ongoing support for nursing homes, including testing and PPE. We're seeing nursing homes just running out or hanging on the balance week by week, ongoing testing and PPE for residents and for workers in nursing homes. That legislation also supported our nursing homes who receive Medicaid to make sure they stay afloat. It also did an independent review of what went wrong in New Hampshire in our nursing homes with recommendations for a second wave. We passed that legislation. Chris Sununu vetoed it. So he won't even do a review of what went wrong. You know, we have over 300 Granite State seniors, Peter, who have been lost to COVID-19 in our nursing homes. Over 300. In some cases, whole floors. It's a heartbreaking situation. And family members on the outside and have to be on the outside looking in, just hoping that their loved ones get by. I used to represent seniors in assisted living facilities when I was at New Hampshire Legal Assistance as a legal aid attorney. They're among our most vulnerable, and it's a reflection of society of how we treat our most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so, go ahead, Peter, sorry.
Oh, sorry, I was just, because our time is short, I did want to get in one more question from someone who emailed in. Senator Feltus June asked, NHPR reported that you chose to accept corporate PAC money and violate the LLC loophole when you decided to run for governor. Why did you make that decision, and why did you then decide to return only some of the money? That's the question from June.
Well, thank you, June. I appreciate it. That's not accurate. We don't take corporate money. We don't take corporate PAC money. And there was some LLC money that came in, and we returned it because even though it's not corporate money or corporate PAC money, I thought it sent a better message. And by the way, I've spent my career in the state Senate on campaign finance reform, over 30 pieces of campaign finance reform legislation. I've led on it. I continue to lead on it. Our campaign is endorsed by End Citizens United because we do need to end the effect of Citizens United in New Hampshire. Only campaign and only candidate to release his tax returns in this race for governor. Only candidate to sign the People's Pledge to get dark money out of politics in New Hampshire. Only candidate to not do any self, sign the pledge to not self-fund a campaign here in New Hampshire. So we put forward a plan about how we're going to move forward with real reform, with real results for working people and working families. And that's what this is all about. Whose side are you on, working people and working families or corporate special interests? And again, looking forward to continuing to have these debates and discussions honored to be endorsed by In Citizens United in this race for governor.
One last question for you, Senator Feltes, and it comes from Aaron. Aaron writes, experts have said that due to the combination of the moratorium on evictions ending and the $600 federal unemployment coming to an end, states across the country are facing economic and housing crises. What would you do as governor to prevent a housing crisis and a homelessness crisis?
Well, we laid it out, and this is something that I worked on as a legal aid attorney for about 10 years, including during the last economic crisis, the Great Recession. I represented homeowners being foreclosed on by Wall Street banks all around New Hampshire, battled against them, protect people's homes. We passed legislation, House Bill 1247, to protect people's homes from foreclosure from Wall Street banks, foreclosing on homeowners falling behind on their mortgage from COVID-19, requiring that banks work in good faith with folks who need help.
So if you were governor right now, would you institute a continuation of a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures?
I would institute a continuation of some hybrid model of a moratorium. But here's the point, Peter. We passed legislation to protect homeowners from foreclosure, protect renters. And Chris Sununu just vetoed it. He allowed the moratorium to lapse, and he vetoed our legislation to protect homeowners. And we laid out a plan to invest in housing and homelessness. Chris Sununu unilaterally cut housing and homelessness out of the budget recently. And so I gotta say, this is a huge issue. It's a huge issue, especially right now. And we need to protect homeowners and renters. We took steps to do that. Chris Sununu vetoed those steps. This is one of the major reasons how we build and move forward. And how do we get out of this mess? Do we get out of this mess in a way that looks out for ordinary folks, working people, working families, kind of family I grew up in? My dad worked in a furniture factory for 45 years, the same one doing roughly the same job day in and day out for 45 years. My mom, part-time jobs, including the night shift while raising four kids. But families like the family I come from, families like the families I fought for as a legal aid attorney and in the state Senate, ordinary people, working class folks, working families, are we going to look out for them as we get out of this mess? Or is it just going to be the same old from Sununu looking out for corporate special interests? We know what side he's on. We need a different approach if we're going to get out of this mess in a way that works for ordinary people.
Senate Majority Leader Dan Feltes, running in the Democratic primary for governor, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You got it, Peter. Take good care.
You too. We're speaking with candidates in a variety of races ahead of the September 8th primary. Hear previous conversations and stay up to date with new ones by subscribing to the Exchange podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, or check out nhpr.org. Still to come, Governor Chris Sununu's COVID-19 equity response team released a report yesterday about New Hampshire's response to the pandemic. The team was created in May to investigate how COVID-19 disproportionately impacts communities of color. We'll learn more about the recommendations in the report, and if you've got questions about it, now's the time to give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. Monday on The Exchange, weddings during the coronavirus pandemic. We'll discuss how we're rethinking weddings now and how the industry is adapting. But today, we're taking a look back at the week's news. You can call us with your questions or comments. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Governor Sununu's COVID-19 equity response team released a report this week about New Hampshire's response to the pandemic and COVID-19's disproportionate impacts on communities of color in New Hampshire. Joining me now to talk about this report is Dr. Trinidad Tellez, chair of the COVID-19 equity response team and director of the Office of Health Equity at New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So one of the big takeaways from this report was that COVID-19 didn't create inequities, but it did reveal the connection between infection rates and some of what are called upstream factors. Can you tell us a little bit about these upstream factors that lead to the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on communities of color?
Sure. So we know that the COVID-19 pandemic did not just create the disparities, rather it unmasked the longstanding disparities and inequities that exist in our systems, in our health outcomes, in our populations. The report has a really nice graphic, which has been used in many places around the country. Because I'm very visual, I like to refer to it. But we think of downstream as where we've traditionally focused as a health system, focusing on disease and injury or death. We think of hospital care. We think of seeing the doctor when we're sick. But we know that it's about much more than that that determines our health. In fact, 80% of our health is determined by non-healthcare factors, such as our housing, our access to healthy foods, our access to quality health care, our jobs, whether we have good benefits with our jobs, do we have our health insurance through our employers, all those other factors, education, transportation, environment, and those are called the social determinants of health. Some people call them the environments where we live, learn, work, play, and pray. And more recently, we've become more able to recognize that even underlying the social determinants of health, we can go even further upstream and look at the institutional inequities that perpetuate or create conditions that create inequities. And even further upstream from that are what we think of as the structural social inequities, which is really about racism, classism, and other kinds of isms that really influence how everything plays out as you move downstream.
So as we address the impact of COVID-19, what we're really doing is going way back and addressing the systemic racism that leads to all these conditions that make things worse for communities of color.
Well, there are definitely things we can do to address COVID-19 specifically, but it would be, we can't only look at that, right? We have to recognize that the challenges that are being manifest with the COVID-19 infections and illnesses and deaths, you know, are very much determined by housing conditions or who are the essential workers that are still having to go into sometimes unsafe working environments. Mm-hmm. Who is privileged enough to be able to work from home and still draw an income and not be worried and insecure or have not lost their health insurance because they lost their job? So there's so many factors that tie up. It's really a complex set of systems working together, and so we can't only focus on COVID, although we definitely need to focus specifically on COVID as well. Mm-hmm. So we did issue many recommendations in 11 strategic areas, and we also thought it was important to lay out some foundational background information because some of these topics and concepts are new and we don't usually get to hear about them, you know, on brief news stories or sound bites. And so there are people may have questions about, well, why are we talking about race, or why do we use these race categories, or why are we having the this disparity dashboard that we can look at the state's COVID-19 website that has the numbers, you know, the percentages that we see that demonstrate the disparate impact of COVID. And so the report is fairly comprehensive, in addition to laying out a series of recommendations that are really just the starting point, because we were given 30 days, and this is a very complex situation that requires a lot of lengthy, detailed attention, as well as significant input from community members who are affected, and data and understanding about the populations that we don't have as robustly in New Hampshire as we would like to have.
We should let listeners know that a link to the report is at our website, nhpr.org. New Hampshire's not issued a mask mandate. Where does a mask mandate fit in? Is it one of your recommendations?
It is one of our recommendations. We have a mask mandate for specific situations and environments and high-risk settings, I think is how we worded it.
So not a universal mask mandate.
Not a universal mask mandate. And again, you know, we recognize that there are different factors that need to go into consideration, but we thought that saying mandate mask use in high infection rate areas and high-risk situations or environments spoke to the need. There's a number of, in fact, we have the most recommendations in our first strategy area, which is the COVID-specific recommendations, because there are significant needs for things that need to be done immediately, and we're very grateful that the governor outlined a number of action areas that are either currently underway or that can be implemented in the near future.
One of the aspects of the report dealt with trust, the ability of communities of color to trust the systems in place and the belief in those communities that they have their best interests at heart. To what extent is trust an issue here in New Hampshire when it comes to our health systems?
Well, I can't address that question specifically because we've not had an opportunity to assess that.
We haven't studied, taken a survey or anything like that?
No. In fact, the call for this formation of this group and the issuance of this report came from the Governor's Advisory Council on Diversity and Inclusion. And specifically, there was a request that there be attention by people who have knowledge of cross-cultural methodologies to be able to study and explore all these other complicated factors and upstream dynamics. And we know, though, historically and from around the country, that there are good reasons for why certain populations may not have as much automatic trust of institutions such as the healthcare system. We have the example of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments and many other examples. And so, there is reason for why people may not have automatic trust in certain institutions. So it's up to our healthcare providers to do what's called community engagement, to reach out, to partner with local organizations, to be present in community. And many of our healthcare institutions do a very good job of this. And so being present, always the previous speaker talked about engaging people with lived experience, engaging people from these communities to have part in decision making, to have part in helping to co-create the solutions. Many of the historically marginalized groups use the rallying cry of nothing about us without us. And this was a really important factor we faced and given a charge to write a report in 30 days when we had not had an opportunity to hear the experiences. So we actually immediately started thinking about how could we do surveys, how could we do focus groups, because that's really what's needed to really know what is happening, what are their experiences right now with COVID, the challenges that are being faced, to really then come up with the appropriate solutions. But in the meantime, there's enough knowledge in the group and in the resources we were able to tap in the short amount of time for this initial plan and recommendations, to make some recommendations that we thought we can definitely stand behind and use as a starting point while hopefully we continue to pursue drawing in more expertise and more community partnership for this work continuing forward.
Right, because this report calls for a standing equity response team that will not just let things stop after this report is delivered. It's going to keep going. And it sounds like it's going to keep going in the sense that you'll be bringing in more voices and pursuing more research to get more data on the way things really look on the ground in New Hampshire.
Yes, that is what we hope. And examples in what the governor issued yesterday in the press conference and the day before and in his announcement, there is definitely coming in the coming weeks a much more robust interactive disparity data dashboard. So we're very much looking forward to that. I have been privileged to participate in that work. And the department, again, is working hard to make sure that all our data capacity, because people in New Hampshire want to understand what is happening with COVID and how our populations are being affected. And so what we have now on the COVID-19 website is helpful, and it will be even better.
Dr. Trinidad Tejas, chair of the COVID-19 Equity Response Team and director of the Office of Health Equity at New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a good day.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And here are some of the stories the NHPR newsroom has been following this week. Governor Chris Sununu has signed a bill that will reinstate new drinking water standards for toxic PFAS chemicals. Democrats hailed the signature of the bill, which was opposed by some business groups. The legislation will enact within about 2 years some of the strictest PFAS drinking water standards of any of the handful of states that have such rules. Also, the New Hampshire Food Bank and Army National Guard are hosting a mobile food pantry today at Nashua High North between 1 and 3 p.m., or as long as food supplies last. Food will be distributed drive-through style, so people are advised to stay in their cars when they come. The mobile pantry will drive through Concord next week. And applications are open for a new state program to provide funding to organizations looking to expand summer recreation and sports activities for kids. $2 million from the Federal CARES Act will go towards this program called Empowering Youth. Governor Sununu says day camps and recreational sports programs are among the organizations that can apply for funding, and the deadline to apply is August 17th. Yesterday, NHPR published an investigation into payouts made to settle lawsuits over allegations of police wrongdoing. The story comes as the nation and the state grapple with issues of police accountability, use of force, and systemic racism. NHPR's Todd Bookman was the lead reporter on this piece, and he's with me now by Skype to talk about what he found. Thank you very much for being here, Todd.
Hi, Peter.
So this story is about settlements, essentially financial payments made to settle lawsuits that involve what kinds of allegations?
Well, the records we requested were only about civil rights violations, and that was defined as allegations having to do with excessive force, sexual harassment, racial profiling, all the way up to wrongful death. And so these essentially are claims that citizens brought forward after one of these encounters with police. People either filed a lawsuit or perhaps threatened to file a lawsuit. And then the town and its insurer ultimately decided to settle the case rather than moving forward with a trial.
Okay, so financial settlements to avoid lawsuits. Big picture, Todd, how often does this happen in New Hampshire?
Well, that's what we wanted to find out, especially given the focus on policing and police accountability that's taking place right now nationwide. These settlements are their public records, but there's no real central database, no state agency, not the Department of Justice, the Department of Safety. Nobody tracks these at a statewide level. These files are essentially kept inside of town halls, wherever the case originated. There are more than 230 town halls and cities, towns and cities in New Hampshire, though. So that meant we had to file a right to know request with each one of these municipalities. We started that process in June. And it took a while, but we were able to obtain these records from nearly every municipality. And we asked for records going back about 10 years.
And you received a decent number, I suppose.
Yeah, we did. We received 87 individual settlements. So that's 87 times that a town or a city or the state police, through its insurance company, ultimately paid a citizen to end or dismiss a lawsuit. And the cumulative value of those settlements was $4.35 million. We should note that a settlement, it's not an admission of guilt. Lots of lawsuits involving lots of different matters will end in settlements. And we know that towns will sometimes decide to settle a lawsuit simply because it is cheaper to do so than to go through what can be a really lengthy litigation process. And this happens even when the town and the police department don't think that the allegation has any merit.
And so what were some of the larger settlements that you received records for?
Well, a few of these were already previously known cases. The largest payout in the past decade was $750,000 to the family of a woman named Wendy Lawrence. That payout was earlier this decade. She was shot through the windshield of her car following a police chase, a low-speed police chase. Another high-profile case involved this incident outside of a bar in Manchester where four off-duty cops were alleged to have beaten a man named Chris Miklovich. This was, again, a high-profile case. He received $200,000. There was also a $300,000 payout to a family following a shooting death in Ware. This was described in a report by the Attorney General as a botched drug raid, poorly planned, poorly executed. So those are some of the larger, more well-known cases.
But not all these cases were well covered by the media.
Yeah, exactly. And that's been the most interesting part of the reporting, I think. We did not know, and after receiving them, it seems clear that a lot of these had never been reported publicly before. Again, that's despite them being public records and it ultimately being taxpayer money. And one case that I think sort of highlights this issue was out of 2014 in the town of Farmington, where a man was arrested, allegedly resisting arrest. Police struck him with a taser, actually twice within a span of a few seconds. The attorney general investigated this incident. They found that the second firing of the taser by the police officer couldn't be justified. But before the man ever was able to file a lawsuit, or at least he had threatened to, the town agreed to pay him about $25,000. But that settlement was never reported publicly, and the AG's investigation was also never announced to the public. And then what's interesting about a lot of these cases is that they're then further essentially sealed off from view because the settlement agreements, which again are just a document a few pages long, they often will contain a non-disclosure clause. So that's a gag order. And so this man was prohibited from talking about the case. And this happens, we found, fairly frequently in New Hampshire.
Okay. So an NDA involving alleged police misconduct, pretty common?
Yeah. So not quite half of the 87 settlements we received did include an NDA. We should say that none of the settlements out of Manchester or those involved in the state police, which were the two largest respondents of settlements, those institutions do not appear to use NDAs in any of their settlements. But I spoke with some transparency advocates in reporting this story who said that when the smaller towns and municipalities do use these, it really raises a problem because if people can't talk about their cases and the town is under no obligation to publicize the fact that they settled the case, you end up with this system where nobody essentially knows, how these cases are being settled. It happens sort of in secret. These documents live inside of the filing cabinets of town halls, but we really have no way of knowing that they're in there.
Sorry about that, Todd. We're a little bit of breaking up on your line, but I do have one more question about systemic racism and whether or not there's any evidence of that. Do these settlements shed any light on instances of racial bias in New Hampshire?
Well, they do and they don't. The settlement documents themselves, they don't have any demographic data. So that makes it really hard to figure out what took place in these incidents unless there is a court filing. We know of at least two cases, both out of Salem, where the allegations clearly centered on bias. One involved a young black man tackled outside of a party and then arrested. He claimed that the police referred to him as Jimi Hendrix once he was in handcuffs. He received a settlement payment. Second case out of Salem involved a Latino man who asked an officer for directions. He then alleges that the officer unholstered his weapon, dragged the guy out of his car, all of this allegedly unprovoked. He also received a settlement. So those are two clear examples in the documents that we received. But again, it's hard to know which of these settlements revolve around racism simply because there's no data involved.
I see. And there's another settlement described in your story that caught my eye, and this involves a Keene State student.
Right. So this was a young woman who was charged with a crime. So Keene Police Department, they claim this woman made up a sexual assault, a rape allegation. And so she was charged and prosecuted for filing a false rape claim. And the police publicized this arrest. They sent out a press release. This young woman's mugshot was in the local paper. The criminal case against her was ultimately shelved. She then countersued essentially in civil court for wrongful arrest. And the city paid her $100,000 to settle the suit. And that settlement didn't get any publicity that I was able to find. And it's also one of the settlements that involves an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. So she was not able to discuss it publicly.
NHPR's Todd Bookman. His report is at nhpr.org. Thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Still to come, UNH is trying to quell student concerns about returning to campus and the terms UNH is spelling out for students to safely do so. We'll get an update. Are you a student at UNH? How do you feel about returning to campus? What did you think when you received the notice from UNH about mandating testing before you return? Email exchange@nhpr.org or call us now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is The Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. The University of New Hampshire is putting plans in place to open campus this fall. Recently, UNH asked students to sign an informed consent agreement, which mandates that students get tested for COVID-19 and turn up negative before they return. Students petitioned to move this deadline to sign the agreement to Friday, July 31st. Originally, it was today. For more on this issue, we turn to Joshua Morrill, executive editor of The New Hampshire, the UNH student newspaper. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
There was supposed to be a forum last night where students could speak to administrators about this agreement. We can talk about that, but Joshua, I wanted you to describe first a little bit more about what was, in your view, unsatisfactory about the school's informed consent agreement that they asked you to sign.
Yeah, so they sent it to us on the 17th last week, a week from today, actually. And what was really confusing is I'm sure they were working very hard on it, but as far as like information coming to students, they were kind of milling around, and this was the first kind of concrete document that they sent out to us. And the washing the hands and the wearing the mask and all that stuff, we kind of expected, but the proof of a negative test before you arrive to campus was really where the kind of anxiety and the outrage kind of broke out from the student body.
I see. And can you tell me why specifically, why there was so much outrage about the requirement to be tested and to have the test show up negative?
Yeah, so students, a lot of them basically voiced their opinion, saying that they didn't really know how to get a test, saying that they didn't want to pay for a test, or they didn't really know a mode of getting a test. And also, the university didn't really give out a time frame on the document. So there's a lot of questions concerning that. And, you know, could have been a month before you come to school, or does it have to be a week? And last night they kind of, you know, summed that up and kind of, they said that you have to get it 8 days before you come to school.
Yeah.
Kind of assured that.
Well, I think I read the agreement, the notice that was posted on the New Hampshire's Twitter account, a screenshot of the notice students got. It did say that the school partnered with Convenient MD and Quest, and the tests would be free, and the results would be shared with both the school and the student. Students were upset with that. I'm having trouble understanding why, if it's free, and the school said, "Here's where you go to get it for free," and you can send it indirectly to the school, what students would be upset about?
Yes. So the very first document that they sent out didn't have any of that information on it.
I see.
But the town hall that they had last night, the question and answer, they kind of assured that they would be able to get a test because of the partners that they have with Convenient Quest. And they also so they can get testing on campus from the 12th to the 23rd as well. So they have a lot of resources for students to get a test, so it kind of put them at ease and it really made them feel better about the situation. And even if you live, say, on the West Coast or you're not in New England, you kind of have some of the resources that they're making available. They also so that you can get a test mailed, and they're really being accommodating to students. And the town hall last night kind of assured the student body.
I see. Okay. And I understand that students also had some concerns about the paying of tuition, because the school, as far as I understand it, made it very clear that even if we have to go remote or if some of the instruction is remote, tuition rates aren't going to change. Is that still the line from UNH that you're hearing?
So they kind of changed their tune a little bit on that. Okay. They said that the issue with them not lowering tuition a little bit, since, you know, fall sports are canceled and there's a lot of things that they're not really going to have to use some of the funding for. So basically they said they have to keep tuition the same right now because they don't want all the financial aid information to change for all the students. And if the tuition goes down, the financial aid will have to go down as well. So what they're doing is they'll keep everything the same, and then they'll do payouts later in the semester. It'll make it easier for them and us as well, so we won't have to file for paperwork as far as financial aid is concerned.
Yeah. Okay. And so did it seem from your perspective that this was an explanation that you and your fellow students were happy with?
So I think the kind of the anxiety was more due to the shock factor of it, because we didn't really have any prior information of what rules and regulations we're going to have to follow, what the preliminary guidelines were going to be. So I think a lot of students were shocked at what was on the informed consent agreement, or at least some of it. And I think that what they've come out with since then has really helped students. And I think that the majority are very happy with the efforts that they're putting in and feel a lot safer than they did a week ago.
I see. Okay. I want to shift gears a little bit, Joshua, and ask you about the New Hampshire, your student newspaper, because you recently launched a podcast. So what does the podcast cover?
Yes. So basically, the podcast is going to be very similar to what you guys do here on the Exchange. It's called the TNH Roundup. So it's kind of, we weren't piggybacking off of you guys, but we're summing up the main issues and events from every week, because it's been a long time coming, you know, because obviously, as you guys know, the media world is going more digital, and everyone doesn't want to sit down and read a 2,000 word article every day. So if we can have as many modes of communication, and if we can do podcasts, you know, YouTube content, Instagram, Twitter, if we can inform people in those ways, then hopefully we can bring more clarity to the situation, especially now in the UNH community with all the reopening chaos going on right now. So hopefully we're able to do that. And last week we covered obviously the informed consent agreement, and we're going to continue to update the Seacoast community on that and all the other plans for the university as well.
So if anybody wants to find it, but including students, should they go to their, wherever they get their podcasts, and search for TNH or New Hampshire? What should they search for?
Yeah. So the very first one that we had last week was just on YouTube. Coming next week, starting on Tuesday, it's going to be on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. And we'll put links on social media as well. So it'll be on SoundCloud. It'll be everywhere you can get podcasts, like you said.
I see. Okay. And as far as I understand it, Joshua, this is just part of a broader effort to expand your digital footprint, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So at TNH, we've kind of brainstormed on how to do it for the last, you know, probably decade. And right now, the silver lining with the COVID pandemic is that we've been able to really focus on that digital presence, because we haven't had our print product at school. So usually we print every Thursday, and it's really, our week is centered around that product on Thursday. So we'll come in Wednesday night, and we'll have production, and then it'll come out Thursday. And if we don't have that set routine, then we can kind of have more of a fluid and more up-to-date media, you know. So hopefully we can reach more people digitally and kind of
Thank you very much, Joshua. I apologize for the quality of the line, but we appreciate you telling us about the New Hampshire and also about student response to the informed consent agreement that the universities ask you and other students to sign. Really appreciate your presence today.
Yeah, I really appreciate you, and thanks for the opportunity.
Some other stories that the NHPR newsroom has been following this week. Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center will take over the state's long-term care facility testing program. A North Carolina-based company has been providing so-called surveillance testing for the state. Lori Chibinette, the state's public health commissioner, says having those tests done in-state will be good as demand for COVID-19 testing increases. Also, Governor Sununu has signed off on an omnibus bill that could expand broadband access in New Hampshire. A new law will allow municipalities to form what's called communications district, which would allow small towns to work together to issue bonds to finance the development and construction of broadband in unserved locations. The new law says that the legislature recognizes that, quote, many rural towns individually lack the resources and population to attract infrastructure suppliers and service providers. And a fund set up by the state is now open to help for-profit and nonprofit businesses that haven't qualified for other state funding programs. The GAP Fund has $30 million from the CARES Act coronavirus relief funds, and applicants have until August 4th to apply. And that's it for the roundup. Thanks very much again to our guests today. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Jane Vaughn is production fellow for The Exchange. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Remember, the conversation continues online and at nhpr.org and also at nhpr.org right now. By Degrees, our climate change reporting project that begins in this historic moment. At By Degrees, we tell stories of the challenges and solutions that these intersecting crises are bringing to light, individual stories of resilience and struggle, innovation and compromise, of big changes as well. We'll answer your questions through By Degrees, take you to new places, and challenge those in power. You can send in story ideas and check out our latest coverage in By Degrees by going to nhpr.org/bydegrees. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening today. Have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.